Goddard, Reel 16. Tell me about the trial flight of the R-80.
At Walney Island, we had pretty boisterous weather, and so we had to wait several days until there was a suitable calm, because we didn't want to try several experiments at once. Naturally, we'd like to walk the ship out in fairly calm weather with only a light wind, and so it was a beautiful morning. We had no difficulty. It was quite a routine walking out of the hangar and letting her go, and the engines all were producing good performance. They were Maybach compression ignition engines, rather like the Germans, in fact, copies of the German types. We flew head to wind out to the over the Irish Sea before we began to do any manoeuvres, and then we began to do turning manoeuvres at low speeds and then medium speeds before we worked up to top speed. We were coming back over the coast to be seen from the ground at about 1,500 feet up, I suppose, when I decided to go up and have a look at the operation of the gas valves on the top of the ship to see that none were leaking. There were, I think, only 15 gas bags in this ship. There could have been 16. Each of them had a gas valve from which you could detect whether they were leaking gas by taking a gas detector. And I went up onto the walkingway on the top of the ship and visited each of these gas valves, and or at least nearly each of them. I had worked from the forward end right aft and was just about to get to the tail end of the ship, the last gas bag, the smallest, with my gas detector, when there was a frightful jerk and the walkingway on which I was, almost under my feet, collapsed by about 18 inches. And obviously the top girder was broken. I then noticed that all the guys leading to the elevator planes and the tail fin, there was a vertical tail fin as well as a top tail fin as well as a bottom one. I couldn't see the bottom one, of course. But all the controls and the had gone slack, and the tail became, instead of rigid, rather wobbly. This alarmed me because clearly the ship had broken her back at the tail end and the controls were obviously, to me, out of action. So somewhat uphill, head to wind, I walked back crouched back. I think I stood up and walked back against the wind because we were still going ahead, and went down through the tube, through the hull of the ship, to the control car. Well, first of all to the keel and then into the control car, where I found very considerable consternation. The captain of the ship, J.C. Little, was nominally in charge, but in fact Captain Scott, Major Scott he was then called, had taken over control of the ship as the test pilot. Wallace, the constructor, was alarmed because obviously his ship had broken in a way that was inexplicable, and there was general consternation. The helm was jammed hard over, couldn't be put amidships, and the ship was going round in large circles, gradually going downwind away from Walney Island, and nobody apparently knew what to do. They were pretty well shaken by this experience. Well, it so happened that I had had a similar experience in my little SS-40, the black ship which I had in France, where the rudder had jammed. And so when nobody seemed to know what to do, I said, well, if you will put your engines full speed ahead when you're coming towards Barrow, that is to say Walney Island, and then if you slacken back and shut the throttles when she's drifting away, you'll gradually come back, as is obvious, in a series of sort of spirals. And this was what was done, and before long we came back in graceful curves, a series of sort of loops, and landed head to wind in the normal way, quite low, quite pleasantly, without anybody doing anything but pay attention to what was going on in the control car. I mean, there were thousands of people on the ground watching this flight, and the ship was walked into the hangar, tail first, and tucked away, and the nose of the ship was available, and masses of press correspondents and other people gathered round and gained a great deal of news and interest from the trial fight, but I'm glad to say nobody said a word about her being broken. Secrecy was over, the war was over. This was just after the armistice. I can't give you the exact date, but my recollection was that there was no secrecy about this particular flight, and except amongst us in the crew, and we kept absolute secrecy about the ship having broken up. We had in fact broken 73 girders, and the ship, she may have flown again, but she didn't fly again with me because I went away to the Admiralty soon after that to see about the flight of the R-34 across the Atlantic.
What was it like for you living in London immediately after the armistice brought the war to an end?
Well, I had a job to do in preparing, doing the planning for the intended flight of the R-34 across the Atlantic, and that was a serious job. But in the evenings, there was a great deal of distraction. As you can imagine, that within a month or two of the armistice, the great bulk of the British Army, what was it, 5 or 6 million strong by then, all the officers and men, by and large, were overseas, either in France or Egypt or some remote place. The Navy was still largely abroad in the Mediterranean and elsewhere. So there were very few what could be called officer type in London at that time, but there were many, many young women who hadn't had any fun to speak of, and very few dances and that sort of thing in wartime. London suddenly broke out into a rash of social occasions, and men like myself, aged about 22 years of age, were at a premium for dancing partners, and so one could go to a dance every night and stay up till about 4 o'clock in the morning if you weren't careful. I had to be rather careful because I had to do a useful job of work in the daytime. So I used to sleep in my office. Very kindly, this was in Dean Stanley Street, and the airship department had retained the cook when they took over the house, and retained a couple of the servants, and consequently they liked to have somebody living or sleeping in the place, although this was quite unofficial. So privately I arranged for a bed to be put down on the floor of my office, and they used to bring me breakfast in the morning, and I would appear properly dressed, properly turned out at the right time, without having to be a commuter.
This rash of social occasions which you've described, was this symptomatic of the mood of the country?
I would say that all over the country at that time there was a great rejoicing of heart, great relief that it was all over, and everybody who had any money, and quite a lot of people had, because not war profiteering exactly, but people had made money during the war, or had saved money, or had put it away and not spent it on social things, and consequently there was a great mood for entertaining, especially people who had been in the war. The unfortunate thing was that for the first few months of the war, relatively few chaps who had been in the war were then at home.
Shall we go on now to the preparation of R-34 for her flight to the US, with which you were involved?
Well, this, as is generally known, aeroplanes were being prepared to fly the Atlantic either as private ventures or as sponsored ventures by aircraft constructors. The airship idea was a government-sponsored thing. The airship department was mad keen to show that airships could do long-distance travel by far greater ranges than could be contemplated by aeroplanes. Whereas the intention was to fly an aeroplane from the nearest bit of the coast of North America, with the wind behind you, to Ireland. The intention of the airship was to fly head to wind across the Atlantic from England or from Scotland right away to New York, twice the distance, and with against the wind instead of being with the wind, and then to moor in Long Island, as it turned out, and then fly back again and do the double crossing. This, we knew, had in fact been intended by the Germans as a bombing effort, or as a war stunt to impress the Americans. But we did it as a peacetime gesture using our copies of German airships.
What special preparations had to be made to R-34 to equip her for this flight?
She didn't really have any special preparations. She was just a service type ship. She had the capacity. I don't think we put any extra tanks in. The planning that was required was the planning of the ground organization, of getting the Americans prepared to handle the gassing and the fueling and the mooring of the ship, of training people on the ground over there, and also of a meteorological study of the most likely courses for the kind of time of year. And my time was largely occupied with studying meteorological synoptic charts for the travel of depressions across the Atlantic, and calculating various optimum methods of starting out and forecasting the crossing that was likely to be most suitable to the weather involved at the time.